Welcome to Mid-Century Living, your weekly podcast about everything mid-century and how to bring the best of the mid-century to your everyday lives.
Welcome to Mid-Century Living, the show where we talk all about the mid-century then and now. We're your hosts, Jackie
and Gonzalo, and welcome back to our show. But before we get started with today's topic, if you are enjoying hearing about the mid-century, please subscribe, drop us a like on whichever platform you're listening to us on, because it really helps us to know how we're doing and also gets us onto like listeners lists. So Jackie, what's on the docket for today?
So today we are talking about Disneyland Part 2, Building the Park and the Park Today. So if you haven't already listened to Episode 5, go ahead and start there. That's part one, which is more about the original idea of Disneyland and the design layout. So you definitely want to listen to that half first. But today, we're going to continue on our Disneyland history. So, what?
Nope, I was going to just dive right in.
Dive right in. Okay, so originally, Disney wanted to build the park on a vacant 16-acre plot directly across the street from his studio. This was back when it was called the Mickey Mouse Park idea, which he's kind of conceptualized in 1948.
So the city of Burbank, where his studio is located, originally rejected the idea of Mickey Mouse Park. And the original concept was also strongly opposed by bankers, investors, and even some members of Disney's company. Even his brother Roy thought it would lead to financial ruin. So Disney financed the beginning himself by selling his vacation property and borrowing from his life insurance.
Eventually, Disney acquired 160 acres of orange groves and walnut trees in Anaheim, south of Los Angeles, in the neighboring Orange County. He built the site adjacent to the new Santa Ana Freeway and just 38 miles south of Burbank, meaning that the park would be a short 30-minute drive from downtown. Fun fact about this is what seemed like it would be super convenient at the time ended up being a huge disaster because anyone who's been to Disneyland Park now knows just how close it is to the city is actually a flaw more than a feature these days, because it just means locals could pop into the park for fun because it's just so convenient. So weekends and nights at Disneyland Park are a madhouse because people just show up for dinner because it's just right next to town.
I've wondered about that because I've heard people be like, oh yeah, I had lunch at Disneyland the other day.
Yeah, it is overrun with locals. And I mean, good for them. I would do the exact same thing if I lived that close to Disneyland. But if you're saving up for a trip to Disneyland and it's your only time there in years, it is very overwhelming on nights and weekends.
Yeah, I always figured it would be like, you know, when you live in cities that have a touristy attractions, you never really go to those places unless you have like friends and family visiting.
In town, like, and you're like, oh yes, well of course go to the Met while you're here.
Yeah, like no one that lives in Houston goes to NASA. We only go to NASA whenever we have family from out of state. Like, oh hey, you have space rockets here. I'm like, yeah, let's go. It's always a fun time, but no one like, oh, you know what, it's Saturday morning. Hey kids, let's get in the station wagon. No one drives station wagons anymore, but well, anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Disneyland's just that much more interesting, I guess, is the answer.
So should we get on with how it was built? And
yeah, so getting back on topic, being that close, a short 30-minute drive from downtown did make Disneyland Park incredibly convenient. So once they settled on where they were going to put the park, construction began on July 18th, 1954, just a year before opening, and would cost $17 million to complete.
Wow.
So we talked a little bit about Wet Enterprises in the last episode, but basically Walt Disney handpicked his engineers and designers and the team he wanted working on this park, and the amount of craftsmanship that went into this theme park is no joke. Every single inch was built, sculpted, painted by hand. Since the park was so full of original ideas and old antique things from the turn of the century, they found experts where they could and just figured out the rest by experimenting with ideas. They tried to be as authentic as possible with all of the old-timey concepts and elements of the theme park, so the thatched roofs in Adventureland were authentically thatched by hand. The drawbridge in the castle is a functioning drawbridge made using plans that the original castles used in medieval times. The Mark Twain riverboat is an actual functional steamboat built to 5/8 scale, and it was the first functional steamboat to be built in the United States for 50 years.
So the river in Disneyland is obviously not a real river. Do you know if it's ever been moved? Like, could you pick up the riverboat, take it to like the Mississippi, plop it down and not sink?
Actually, yes, I think you could. And also most of the, they didn't build a lot of the big stuff on site. They actually built it in different warehouses and built it to be put back together on site. They brought it over on trucks from different parts of California and reassembled everything in the actual park. Some stuff was built on site, but all of the really big things like the riverboat, the train, all of that was assembled in pieces and put together like a giant puzzle in Disneyland. So they could probably move the riverboat if they had to.
Yeah. I love the idea of the of it being real. There's a Pan Am Museum in Ireland, out of all places, and they have a replica of the flying boats that Pan Am was known for before the jet engines. But the guy that built it, he's like, they asked him to build a like showroom piece to like have as their exhibit. And he's like, no, if we're going to build it, we're going to build it. And he built it. Like, he got plans and built it. It's not a functioning airplane, but it's built from the plants. And I kind of wish that it was functional. Anyway, sorry, tangent.
One last authentic construction fun fact is that the railroad is actually a heritage railroad recreated from scratch, like old-fashioned railroads used to be built.
Oh, cool.
So it is they actually built the track, built the train cars. He wanted to get, actually, all original real train cars, but they ended up recreating a lot of them. For more details into just the incredible craftsmanship that went into this park, I highly recommend watching a pre-opening report from Disneyland, in quotes, that's the name of it. It is an episode of the Disneyland TV show that aired in July 13th, 1955, and it is streaming on Disney Plus. It's basically a final look at many details going into opening the park. Walt opens the special by showing the famous large park map, and he introduces Winston Hibler, who narrates a behind-the-scenes tour of Imagineers designing and building the rides and the shows that are about to open. And that's where you see things like the train cars being built off-site and brought in by truck, and the pieces of the Mark Twain and all of that. Figuring out how to waterproof the moat around the castle and the river that we were just talking about where the riverboat is, like, they had to figure out how to do all of that because no one else had done it before. So it's a real celebration of the artists and all of the incredible hard work they put in. So I highly recommend watching that if you're into Disney history. So the pre-opening report was July 13th, 1955. And in July 17th, 1955 is the official grand opening ceremony of Disneyland Park. It was meant to just be smaller opening to special guests and the media. So they had opening ceremonies and they were televised nationwide. And there was a whole dedication ceremony, a band playing the national anthem, and a flyover by the California Air National Guard. You can actually watch all of this in horrible quality on archive.org. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to watch the opening day ceremonies. It is interesting.
Interesting. That's cool. Were there any issues, though, with opening day?
Oh, boy, were there. So I mentioned that it was supposed to be just a small opening to special guests in the media. They were planning on there only being a crowd of 15,000 people because it was supposed to be an invitation-only opening. However, 28,154 people passed through Disneyland's gates thanks to counterfeit tickets. And even more hilariously, a couple people scaled the fence because some entrepreneur showed up and charged $5 a head for people to climb up his ladder and jump the gate. But they ended up calling opening day Black Sunday because just so much went wrong. They were famously painting and hammering right up to the actual opening of the gates. A few of the attractions, Rocket to the Moon, Peter Pan, and Dumbo the Flying Elephant, were not working yet. It was 100 degrees out and July, and the fresh asphalt on Main Street melted into a sticky mess, and some women lost their heels in the asphalt.
Sounds like Texas this summer.
Yeah, sounds like Texas. Well, they're not used to that there. There was, on top of all that, there was a plumber strike happening, so the drinking fountains weren't working. The Mark Twain riverboat, which was ended up being filled beyond capacity, and it started taking on water and tilting. So basically, the opening ceremony was a huge mess. But it proved that his idea was popular and probably set up for success. Everyone seemed to have a good time, even though it was a huge disaster. And everything was just up from there. If you want to see how much it flourished, another episode of the Disneyland TV show available for streaming is called Disneyland Around the Seasons from December 18th, 1966. At this point, the Disneyland TV show was renamed Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. This one is in color, and it looks so much more like the Disneyland park we know today. It is, you can tell that they are thriving. Since opening day, they have 60 million visitors come in those gates. The Matterhorn's there now, which opened in 1959. Basically, this episode is Walt taking us on a tour to point out the newest additions to the park. The newest attraction is It's a Small World, which just opened in May 1966. This episode spotlights It's a Small World, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, which is famous for the audio animatronic of President Lincoln. That the big deal about it is that he starts off sitting and then ends up standing while he gives a speech, which is a really cool thing for a robot to do in the 60s. And New Orleans Square is now a thing, which will later be home to the Haunted Mansion and the Pirates of the Caribbean, which are in development at this point, but not open for several more years.
I'll say the Haunted House is one of my favorite attractions, so listeners, be on the lookout, because who knows?
Maybe we'll do an episode about that.
Yeah.
One bittersweet thing that makes this episode particularly interesting is that it's the first episode of the Walt Disney TV show that aired after his death. He actually died 3 days before this episode aired. It's a little sad to watch, but it's still, you could tell how happy he is, and it's like a real celebration of how important this park is to so many people and just how interesting and beautiful it is. And it's really, it's especially if you watch the opening day celebrations and issues, and it's in black and white and all, like, the film quality is not great. And then all of a sudden, here's this new special in 1966, and it's in color, and it's flashy, and there's the band, and like, it's just, it's really great to watch both of them. I highly recommend it.
Okay, I'm going to have to put that on my list.
So, one other thing that was interesting about the park in this time was, and that's very different than how it is now, is the ticketing system. So from Disneyland's opening day until 1982, you paid a very small admission fee just to get into the park, but to go on the rides and attractions, you actually had to buy tickets for them, either individually or in a book. So the ticket coupon books, the tickets were labeled A through C, originally anyway. A tickets were smaller rides and attractions like the horse-drawn streetcars on Main Street, and then C tickets were used for the common attractions like Peter Pan's Flight or the Mad Tea Party. You could actually combine coupons to equal the equivalent of another ticket, like 2A tickets would be 1B ticket. As more thrilling rides were introduced, though, like the monorail or the Matterhorn bobsleds, D and eventually E tickets were introduced. These days, actually, Disney nerds use the term e-ticket attraction to refer to the most in-demand attractions, even though we don't actually use ticket books anymore.
Oh, that's cool. So we're still using some of the stuff, some of the yeah. wording, at least.
Yeah, and like press releases, they'll even say like a new e-ticket attraction, and you just know what it means if you know.
Nice. So that's a nice little segue into talking about today.
So Disneyland, the park, still really feels like Walt's park, and a lot of the original attractions are still running today. So the opening day attractions from July 17, 1955 that are still in operation are Autopia, the Disneyland Band, the Disneyland Railroad, the Jungle Cruise, the King Arthur's Carousel, the Mad Tea Party, the Main Street Cinema, the Mark Twain Riverboat, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, Peter Pan's Flight, Snow White's, Scary Adventures now, and the Storybook Land Canal Boats.
Nice.
Attractions that were built between 1955 and 1966 that are still in operation are the Casey Jr. Circus Train, Dumbo the Flying Elephant, Davy Crockett's Explorer Canoes, the Shooting Gallery in Frontierland, Alice in Wonderland, the Sailing Ship Columbia, the Dapper Dans, which are a barbershop quartet on Main Street, and they're awesome, the Monorail, the Matterhorn Bobsleds, the Enchanted Tiki Room, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, and It's a Small World.
I love the Dumbo ride, not necessarily like as a ride, but those of us who are familiar with the 90s will remember the Disney VHSs. And at the beginning of every Disney VHS, they always had like little like Disney World Studios or whatever it was, like little like come to our park promo. And the first thing you always saw was Dumbo.
Mm-hmm.
So
I feel that way about the Mad Tea Party, which I actually don't enjoy riding. The teacups. Because I just do a lot of eating at Disney parks, so that ride doesn't appeal to me very much. But the image of people like having fun spinning in circles in the teacups is, to me, is like the theme park experience.
Yeah, actually. I mean, all these, I guess rightly so, because they've been there forever. But Dumbo, It's a Small World, Lincoln, the Tea Party, Main Street even. Like, you think Disney parks, you think those bits and pieces. And like now we've grown so much, you know, with the addition of Star Wars and stuff. Yeah. But I love that we still have these classic bits, attractions still going.
Yeah, they've expanded a lot, but it's a very impressive list that I just rattled off of original attractions still functioning in Disneyland.
But this Disneyland's impact, or really Walt Disney's impact, is not just about how it impacted his park, because Disney changed how the entertainment sector viewed places like theme parks. Previously, you know, they were either dirty or cluttered. Theme parks simply had flashy events and rides. Once the event was over, the customer was hastily ushered out to make room for the next customer. Disney wanted the opposite. We talked about it in the last episode, how he wanted a world where the guest, not the customer, was the center of the experience. And he wanted people to stay there as long as possible. And that's really, really big impact on today. Today, the whole entertainment business is centered around the customer experience, which is directly connected to the success of Walt Disney's first park, Disneyland. For more info on Walt Disney and the park, you can check out Walt Disney's Disneyland, a book by an architectural historian and theme park enthusiast named Chris Nichols. It's a really cool book. He talks about how Walt Disney came up with the idea from working with composers like Richard Sherman and the Imagineers, and how it made it to fruition.
And Disney's idea of the guest being the center of the experience, and he wanted them to stay as long as possible, is definitely still part of it today. Walt Disney World, which Disney was there to conceptualize it, but sadly died before it opened. But this time they learned from Disneyland and bought more land up. I mentioned earlier that it's just so close to the city. They kind of learned their lesson about that with Disney World, and they had, quote, the blessing of size. And now they actually are able to control the guest experience in the sense that the resorts, once you get to Disney property, you're just completely taken care of. You have buses that take you from the resort to the park, and from the park back to the resort. They used to pick you up at the airport and bring you back to the airport. It's just like a whole, once you're there, Disney controls your whole experience and all of it seamless and comfortable and happy. And that was all his original idea. And they're still trying to stay true to that today, which I really appreciate.
Yeah.
So, Gonzalo, have you ever been to a Disney park?
I have. I've been to both Disney parks in the States. I've been to Disneyland when I was little, and we did not live in the States yet. And we did a special trip to come to LA and went to Disneyland there. And then we did the same thing, Disney World. We came to Disney World, and then once more, once we already lived in the States, we went to Disney World. I've never been to any of the Disney parks outside of the U.S., although for a moment I was excited because there was a rumor that Disney had bought land between Austin and Houston for a park. I don't know, I have zero idea if that's true or not, but that was the rumor when we were in high school.
Yeah, I remember that rumor now. It would be nice if there was another park in the middle of the country.
It would, but Texas is hot.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, no one would want to go 6 months out of the year.
Yeah. Have you been to any of the million parks? I don't know, there's not a million, but...
I have. So I grew up in the Northeast, so we went to Disney World in Florida a lot. I used to go almost every year growing up for a while. I've been to Disneyland less, maybe 3 times ever. And it's definitely a very different experience. Like, you can tell that they're trying to keep... I mean, Disney didn't want anything to be a museum. He wanted it to always be changing. But they kept a lot of his original ideas intact and original attractions intact. And it really feels like a... Like, you can feel the history when you go to Disneyland. It's very different than going to Disney World. I have also been to Disneyland Paris twice. But back that was before they had their own studios park, which I hear is not doing very well. And all three of the Disneyland-style parks, the Disneyland Park in Anaheim and the Magic Kingdom in Florida and Disneyland in Paris, all are true to Walt's original vision, single entrance, central hub with a castle, Fantasyland, Adventureland, Tomorrowland, and everything's just all in the exact same directions that you mentioned before. Like, Fantasyland straight through the castle, Tomorrowland's to the right. It's exactly the same. Like, no matter which one you're in, you know how to get around. It's amazing.
Have you ever been on a Disney cruise?
I have. I've been on several, actually. All of them on the Wonder, I think, because that's the one that leaves from Galveston.
Are there multiple ships?
Oh boy, are there? Yeah, there's... Oh shoot, I wish I had that off the top of my head. I can effort that if you stall.
Well, look for it. Because, okay, so I love cruise ships. I think they're the great vacation. I've only been twice, but twice in the past 2 years. So when we were in the Alaska cruise ship over summer, we were docked... I forgot where it was, but we were docked in a little island that basically just exists for cruise ships. And I thought there was only one dock. I was like, oh, cool, we're the only people here. And we went through, like, a little attraction that was there, and all of a sudden we walk out of this, like, little shopping center, and it's packed. And I'm like, why is it packed? Well, come to find out that Disney Cruise had just docked. And they looked really cool. I like that they look like old school ocean liners. Like, Carnival and Norwegian are cool looking, but the black hull of an old school liner like Titanic, you can still see that in the Disney ships.
Yes, they do, and they all look like that. So there are 6 Disney ships. The Treasure is the newest one that will start sailings in 2024. I've been on the Magic and the Wonder, which are the 2 oldest ships. The Magic leaves from... Most of them leave from Port Canaveral in Florida, but the Disney Wonder comes to Galveston all the time, which is why I've been on that one more, because I can just drive to Galveston. Whereas the other ones, you have to fly to Florida and then get on the ship.
Yeah.
But the original The Guest Is Always Right, full, beautiful customer experience is not quite as good in the parks as it used to be, probably just because there's just so many crowds and it's just like a very overwhelming experience. But it's a little harder to feel like you're totally transported out into another universe while you're there, just because reality kind of slips in a little bit every now and then. But on Disney cruise ships, it is way more, you're definitely in a totally different, like, magical experience than it is when you're in the theme parks these days. So if you are a Disney fan, even if you do not have children, I highly recommend going on a Disney cruise, because it's really, it's incredible. They take care of you from the beginning to the end. There's Broadway-style shows. The food is delicious. They actually make it, I don't know if they do this on other cruise ships, because once we started going on Disney cruise, we stopped going on other ones, but they rotate you around the restaurants so that you're eating in a different place every night, so that you're seeing the whole ship and you're trying all the food.
Oh, cool.
But your wait staff travels with you, so you can bond with them the whole time.
That's cool.
And they'll recognize your drink choices and who eats what bread from the bread bowl, so that they just like fill up the ones that they know you're going to eat, and they like learn your habits the whole trip.
That is cool. So in other cruise lines, I've traveled in Carnival and I've traveled in Norwegian. Carnival does the like seated tables, but you're always in the same restaurant though. But I love the idea of having a table. The first cruise I ever went on, I went on a cruise by myself. But it was cool because they sat me at a table with, it was like a six top, and there were four people at the table. So like I saw them every dinner service, and then the waiter was the same guy every dinner service. So like you said, the Disney one, like they knew what we wanted. They knew how we wanted things. But Norwegian does it differently. Norwegian like is called a free at sea, which is cool, but like you don't have a dining table. So like I've never been on Norwegian by myself, but I would imagine it'd be very different, because you are like, okay, today I'm going to eat at this dining room, tomorrow I'll eat at that one, and you basically just go to the hostess and like, hey, table 4-4. But if you're by yourself, I don't know how that would work.
And they just seat you like it's a regular restaurant. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So like, are there dining times on Disney cruises? There's like, you either have early dinner or late dinner. And the idea is that like half the ship eats first and then goes and watches the show. And then the other half watches the show and then eats dinner afterwards.
Yeah. So that's how Carnival does it. Norwegian does like just whenever you want.
Fascinating. That sounds, yeah, I guess that everyone just kind of sorts themselves out that way. It's very free range. I like it. That's interesting.
Yeah. Free Etsy. Sponsor us, Norwegian. But anyway, it sounds from this tangent like we are getting close to the end of this episode. So let's land the plane real quickly and talk a little bit about etiquette. So today's etiquette segment comes from a 1941 book, which is a little bit before mid-century as defined in our first episode. But the book is called The New American Etiquette. Jack, do you know there's a correct way to announce the birth of a baby? Or did you wait, did you even know people announce births of their kids?
I did know that people announce them. My sister just had a baby and she announced it.
Did she really?
Yeah, I have it on my fridge. She like sent out a card with a picture of the baby and proud parents and her birth weight and everything. Like it's a thing. But I didn't know that there was a correct way to do that. But I didn't know that it was a concept.
Yes,
I'm excited to hear about the proper etiquette about it.
So it is the first social duty of parents of a newborn child to, quote, notify everyone who may be interested that the world's population has increased by one, end quote.
Everyone who may be interested. I love that.
Yeah. There's no established formality. So telephone can be used, post, meaning mail, maybe utilized. This book for 1941 also recommends using the telegraph. So you could say, send a message to like a friend, right? Very informal, say something like, Bill, it's a boy, come get your cigar, Tom, right? to a relative, it'd be a little bit more, you know, personal. Like, hey, Aunt Mary, John Henry Carter Jr. has just arrived. Everybody's well. Love, Mary and John. Like, that would be a way to, like, send it to your relatives. And it is, according to the etiquette, it is only necessary to announce the birth only to relatives and intimate friends. If you live far from your native community, or you are one of the Joneses in a big community, it's correct to notify the newspapers. Or you could notify an editor and let him make your secret public.
Hmm.
Yeah. So what do you think about that etiquette?
the use of words like necessary are giving me pause. I don't think that you should be required to announce the birth of your baby, but I think if you want to, you absolutely should.
I love getting the announcements from like friends, because then I keep them and I frame them, and like, I don't know, I like that. I don't know about opening up a newspaper, although last time I bought the newspaper was when the Astros won the World Series. but I don't know about picking up a newspaper and like, I wonder who was born this week.
Yeah, I'm fine with the concept of a birth announcement. So, okay. But I think that you should be able to opt into it. So I don't know. I don't know if that's an answer.
You know what? I'm in the same boat as you. Like I like the idea, but I think it's like a personal thing. Like friends, family, that's fine. I don't think we need to let Time Magazine know. I mean, unless maybe if you're like the King of England. then yes. Sure.
But I think it should be considered socially acceptable to announce the birth of your baby if you so choose to.
I think it should be socially acceptable. However, I don't know if I would give it the mid-century living stamp of approval, because I don't think it should be part of etiquette. I think it's just something you do if you want to do it, mm-hmm. but there shouldn't be like social standards. Like the first social duty of a parent should not be to
tell everyone.
Let the world know. Yeah.
Yeah. The first
that's my stance.
Should be to begin raising their child. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So I am fine not keeping this as part of our current etiquette.
Okay.
Ooh, I think you that's the that? First one we've decided not to keep.
I think so. You've heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Only took us 6 episodes.
All right, everyone. Well, we've reached the end of Disneyland today. Please make sure you guys are following us on all our platforms. On Instagram, we are at MCL Podcast. And you can also email us at info.mcliving@gmail.com with comments, questions, future show ideas.
See you next week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Mid-Century Living. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at MCL Podcast. See you next Friday.